So what we're talking about earlier on with TCP, UDP, those just give you the mechanisms for being able to send messages from clients to servers. What they don't tell you is what the messages are, because that depends upon your protocol design. And what the protocol does is to specify the types of messages the client's sending so that the receiver can work out what they are, and the types of replies that come back from the server so that the client can work out what the messages are. And it's basically a simple language that's being set up. And if one side doesn't know the language, you can't talk. So you try and specify it. It's just like English to French. If you don't know the other language, there's no hope. So you've got to have an agreed language. And what's done with all of the internet protocols is that they're all written down as formal specifications of the protocol so that anybody can write a client and anybody can write a server. And when they work properly, like HTTP servers, anyone can write an HTTP server, anyone can write an HTTP client because the specification's public and fixed. Cases where it's not, for example, the SMB protocol, which is the Microsoft file sharing protocol. Some of you might have heard of Samba. Samba is the Unix system which tries to talk SMB protocol to Microsoft machines. And what Microsoft keep doing is, well, the protocol, when it was published, was not published very easily to understand. It was incorrect. The servers didn't actually implement it. In order to write Samba, the people who are writing Samba actually had sniffers on the internet, on the Ethernet cable, to try and figure out what the messages were. So they had to decode the protocol by seeing what the raw data was passing across the network. That's a really hard way of doing things. So it's much nicer if you can get something that's written down and says what's going on. There's a whole bunch of different parameters to look at. You know, whether you're going to use a broadcast protocol or a point-to-point protocol. If you're broadcast, you need to be, UDP multicast. There's an experimental thing called M-Bone, but nobody seems to use that anymore. So for a lot of the cases, unless you're doing things like multiplayer games, then most times you'll be doing point-to-point. There's a big issue about state, whether you're maintaining state about the other side or not. What you basically got is what you'd have with a single application, you get lots of state in things like global variables and global objects. As soon as you spread the thing across two different machines, is this going to know about the state that's in there, or does it get told about it all the time? And simple little example. Supposing you've got a server that you need to log into. So before you can talk to that server, you need to send your user ID and your password. Two possibilities. The first time you connect, you send your user ID and password. And from then on, this side remembers that bit of information, user ID and password. It keeps state about the client. Okay. So if anything goes wrong, then with the connection, or if anything changes, if this side changed its name and this side wasn't told about it, then it would be out of sync. So if you've got state, any change that's made on one side has to be transmitted to the other side to keep it up to date. The other alternative is stateless, and that means if you want to talk and you've got to use a user ID and password, every single message that you send has got to have the user ID and password in it. So it's a trade-off. If you maintain state about the other side, there's the possibility of inconsistency. If you don't maintain state, you have to send that information every time. Okay. And you see this with things like using cookies for browsers to HTTP servers. Browsers are used to transfer state information. So the server builds up state with, say shopping carts. As you put more things into the shopping cart, The server builds up that information, and it's always indexed by the cookie. If your client turned off cookies, then you can't build shopping carts, because you don't know, the server doesn't know who's talking to it. So there's tricks that you need to look at, whether you're doing stateful or stateless, and it's a big sort of design decision. Reliable versus unreliable. If you don't care about reliability, we can use UDP. If you do care, you want TCP. Replies needed. And this then, you're looking at round trips. What do you do if you don't get a reply? Do you assume that the client's died, the network's slow? There's all sorts of error possibilities that can occur in here. And this can be particularly problematic. Supposing you're doing things like bank accounts. If you don't, if you send a message saying, take $1,000 out of my account, and you don't get a reply, does that mean the $1,000 has gone out of your account? Or does it mean it hasn't gone out of your account? So if you don't get a reply, you're stuck with knowing what's going on. So that can be quite complicated trying to handle that. Things like data format. This is a bit more mundane, but fairly important. Data format is, are you going to send things in text form, or are you going to send things as bytes? An example where you get text is HTTP, for example. All the messages are in clear text. Where's one that isn't data?
Daytime is 4:13.
No, I didn't want that. I didn't want daytime. I
that's 4:13. Which is the other time one?
37. Okay, maybe you can try this yourself. If you can find a day server or a time server on port 37, the daytime on port 13 uses a string format. The time server on port 37 uses a byte format. What it sends is a 32-bit integer for the current time. And if you try and read it as a string, well, you're not going to get anywhere. So your reads for that type of data has to be that it's reading bytes, and it's interpreting bytes as forming integers or other things. So you've got a choice as to whether you want strings or whether you want bytes. We'll talk about that a lot more later. Bursty or steady stream, this is for things like if you want to do streaming audio or video, you have to pay attention to that. And if you're sending two streams, pay attention to that. We'll talk a bit more later as to whether you're trying to build a standalone system or a library which is generally used. Okay, one of the things which is a bit of a nuisance is version control. And that is, no matter what your intentions are, you'll start off with version 1 of your client and your server and your protocol. And then after a while of using it, you'll decide that there's more you want to do. So there's maybe more messages that you want to send. So you upgrade everything. So you upgrade the protocol to version 2, your client to version 2, your server to version 2. And then somebody who doesn't know anything about it is still using version 1. So you've then got version 2 talking to version 1. So what should happen is, if in the sort of ideal world, is if you've got a client that talks version 1, well, that'll only be able to talk version 1 to anything. So to a server, it'll only talk version 1. Client that's talking version 2 should be able to talk to a server that understands it using version 2 protocol. But if one of them is an old one, so a client version 1 trying to talk to a server that knows version 2, well, the server has to go backwards. It has to say, oh, well, even though I know version 2, the client doesn't understand it, so it has to drop back to talking version 1. And similarly, even if the client talks version 2, when it sends a message off to the server, it's going to get replies using version 1, so the client has to be able to understand all versions 2. And so this sort of version creep problem is something that every time you upgrade the protocol, the clients and the server still have to understand the old version, unless it's too different. And part of that protocol setup should involve version information. So when you first establish the connection between them, send along the information about what version it is so that the client and the server can figure out which version they need to be talking. And the web's a good example of that, because that went through a whole heap of versions, and the first sort of public one was 0.9. And in 0.9, they didn't have any version information. So they'd do something like get a URL. And there was nothing about versions in there. When they went to HTTP version 1.0, they realized that they needed to put in that extra version information, so they appended it as a tag, 1.0 or 1.1, and that's where it currently is. So if you get a message which has got, and it doesn't matter whether you're a 1.1 or a 1.0 server, if you get this message, you have to talk 1.0 back. If you get no version information, you have to talk 0.9 back to it, because that's what it stands for. And it's only when the client sends that message and the server understands version 1.1 that you get proper version 1.1 stuff happening. So it's not too bad with HTTP, so that's your sort of wire protocol. The actual messages that are sent, client and server can figure out fairly easily, because there's only three possibilities. If you look at the content, it's a real mess. Have any of you done web programming, preparing HTML for IE and Mozilla and Firefox and all the different things? There's four different versions of HTML. There's different tags. So for example, Netscape introduced a tag called blink, which goes blink, 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 blink. But that wasn't understood by IE, because they weren't so stupid as Netscape in that case. Content handlers, if you send PNG documents around the place, then you've got to have a content handler for PNG documents. And they don't always exist on some of the older ones. Some style sheets, when style sheets first came out, nearly every browser would crash on one style sheet or another. JavaScript, where you've got at least two official versions of JavaScript, plus ECMAScript, which is the standardized version. And apparently, according to Des Casey at any rate, even now, the Netscape version of JavaScript is slightly different from the standard ECMAScript version. And they've got different things. There's layers within Netscape, and you don't have layers in IE. So there's different stuff in both of them. Java, the runtime engine for Java, the normal one you get with IE is a 1.3 Java, whereas with others it's 1.4, and the syntax can be sloppy anyway. So if you're writing a web server to try and deal with lots of these different browsers, you've got a really hard job, because there's so many variations. There's one company which I think it lists about 100 different versions of IE and Netscape, talking about the differences between them and how you can figure out which one you're actually trying to talk to. It's not perfect, but to make something robust, you've got to go through all sorts of hoops. There's only one network protocol which seems to try and address that in any sort of sensible way, and that is called JNLP, Java Network Launching Protocol. It's also called Java Web Services, Java WS. And what it does, it sets up a new document type, no problems, and document type is a .jnlp. And so you go to a website and you pull down one of these JNLP documents, And what it's describing is a Java application. So it's trying to say, you want a Java application to run on your client, and you want it to be the most up-to-date Java version that you can find. So what this JNLP does is it's got all the version information. It'll say, needs Java 1.4 or Java 1.5. It needs these packages. It needs, basically, normally it's either the version of Java or the packages that it needs. And what your helper side package has got to do, your helper side thing will look at the stuff in JNLP and also rummage around your local disk and say, this application requires Java 1.5 and I can only find Java 1.4. So what it does is then connects to Sun, downloads Java 1.5, installs it, and then starts running Java 1.5 for you. So it will pull down all the stuff that it needs in order to try and get the Java application running. So you end up with a little thing like this. So you start off with your browser. Where does it go? So it goes off to a web server, and the web server has got the JNLP file stored locally, so it returns that JNLP file. Sends it off to the helper side on the client. So WebStart looks inside the JNLP file, and for example, things like a jar file. It'll look and say, I've got an old version of the jar file, but I need a new version, because the JNLP says newer version needed. So it will then go out to wherever the JNLP says that this file is and pulls down that new jar file and stores it locally. When it's got everything up to date locally, it will then run the Java application. So it acts as a sort of a network version of bringing things up to date before it runs things. There's a couple like that, but not very many. One of the major topics that you have to look at when you're sending data from one side to the other, part of the protocol is to say, how are you going to send bits of data around the place? So how are you going to send things like records, arrays, strings, tables, and things like that? So this whole topic is a thing called data serialization, and it's how do you put all your bits of data out onto the network so that when it gets to the other side, it can be pulled back into the right shape? Some things are easy. If you want to send an integer across, we send an integer, and that's still an integer at the other end. If you want to send a character, that's easy to figure out. It's a character at the other end. But some of these more complicated things, there's choices that you can look at. So for example, supposing you wanted to send a table, a three row, two column table across from one side to the other. One of the ways of doing it might be to say, we've got three rows. We might have a table which has got any number of rows. So you might say, well, for this particular table, it's got three rows, so we'll send a three. Having sent the three, there may be an assumption between both sides. Both sides might know it's two columns. So we'll say both sides know it's two columns, but they don't know how many rows. So by sending the three, you tell the other side how many rows of data it's going to get. And then you send the data. You could send it by columns, or you could send it by rows. And we'll assume, again, that both sides are assuming that, no, you're both sending it by rows. Then the possibilities might be how many characters. So firstly send the number of characters and then the word. Then for the next one, number of characters and then the word. Switch to the next row, characters, word, and so on until you finally sent the whole table. So that relies upon both sides knowing it's two columns, both sides knowing you're sending it row by row, and if you've done that, then this format will get the information across. Other possibilities might say, okay, rather than sending the length of the word, we'll put a character at the end of it which says, this is the end, because it's not a legal character. In which case you only need to send 3, and then Fred 0, Programmer 0, Leaping 0, Analyst 0, and so on. And by reading the string when you hit the 0, you know you got to the end. And that's okay too. Or another possibility might be make everything, say, a fixed number of characters long and just pad them. So that's an 8-character one, here's an 8-character one, here's another 8-character one with different amounts of padding at the end. There's a 10-character, analyst with padding is 10 characters, manager with padding is 10 characters. All of those three ways are fine. Doesn't matter which one you choose. All that you have to do is to specify it. So when you write down this protocol specification would say something like the number of rows, the number of columns is fixed, we're sending them row by row, and within each row we're sending whatever the format is. And once you say what it is, clients and servers can both figure it out. Okay. Some of you, I think, have come across this thing called Java serialization and are saying, well, why can't we use this for the assignment? Because it makes it a lot easier. And what Java serialization does is to say, so what the Java programmers did was they looked at this problem of serialization of data as a general problem, came up with a general solution, but they've only applied it to Java. So this is a serialization mechanism that works for Java objects and doesn't work for C++ objects and doesn't work for C# objects, doesn't work for C data types or anything else. Only works for Java. And what they've done is they've figured out how to serialize things so that all you need to do is create an object output stream. With that object output stream, there's a method called writeObject. You plonk the object in there, and it does all the serialization, spreads it out as a stream of bytes, sends that stream of bytes across the network, so that when you do read object, then it puts it all back together again for you. And this is how things like RMI work, remote method invocation. They send objects across the network by writing object, read object. And so all of the hard work is done for you. And it can be done with lots of different things, persistent objects, all sorts of different things, RMI, remote method invocation, and so on. Okay, this one is banned from the first assignment because it's Java only. And if you tried writing down that object serialization spec, then nearly every C program would look at it and say, huh? It's not trivial, it's not easy, and you can't just look at the bytes and say, oh yeah, well that's what the object was. XML serialization that we'll talk about later, that's fine because you can actually draw up a DTD or a schema which describes the XML serialization, and it's simple enough that programmers who don't know what the serial form is can still write programs to understand it. So from a DTD you can figure out what it is. From the RMI spec or serialization spec, it's too Java specific to be general purpose. Okay, so you've got to look at things like the data serialization, and we'll come back to that again more next week, but not the object serialization. You've also got to look at the message format. So there's the bits within messages and the messages themselves. And what you'll have is a whole bunch of different messages. Things like a login request from the client to the server, get record request from client to server, login reply from server to client. So you've got messages going in different directions and they're different messages. So the general structure is that you're going to have the client prepares a message to send, the server will send that message back, or a message reply back, and there's got to be some agreement about format. Over the years, with all the different protocols that have come up, What has generally happened is the first part of the message somehow tells you what the message type is. And it's usually something like the first word. So nearly all protocols will start off by saying, there's the word that tells you what the message type is. And it's the first word of the message. So when you're designing your protocol, you'll normally say, what are the messages? What are strings or things that you can use just to label each different type? And then following that would be the data that goes along with that message. So, and the messages, they're different messages different ways. See, this is a message, login from client to server, and it's got two pieces of data. Here's a message, reply back. It might use the same word, but it's a different message because it's coming in different directions and with different meaning for that message. The message types can be, they're your choice. If you're using a string format, they can be strings, and that's typically like HTTP format. And that uses strings, as integers, or they could be integers themselves. So you could have actual integer values. So rather than a word login, there might be a value like one. The byte value one, this might be one, that message might be byte value two. You can, whatever convention you want can be used. Just has to be specified. The two main choices that you've got are whether you're going to use strings or whether you're going to use things like byte encoding, which is bytes, integers, and so on. Okay. Byte format. The byte format is used by lots of protocols like X-Windows, like Samba, FTP, Telnet. A lot of these older ones don't use strings for messages, but they use bytes to distinguish between message types. And the rest of the data is often in bytes too. So if you've got something which is using a byte format, then when it comes to, you set up a socket, you read something from the socket, and you've got to figure out what the message is that's been sent to you. And that message handler, if you're using a byte format, you usually look at the first byte. And then you do a switch statement based on that. And within the switch statement, you're handling each different message type. And after that, you've usually got more message content in some format. We'll talk about that. The advantage of using that is that usually bytes are smaller than strings. So if you're sending something like, if you're using HTTP, HTTP is string-based, and that has messages like get, which is three characters, post, which is four characters, three bytes, four bytes. If you're really concerned about speed and network capacity, then it's better to use one byte instead of three. So they were usually done for compactness and speed. The problems are that you can't use simple debuggers to figure out what's going on. If it's a string format, you can do Telnet, act as a client. If you've got a network sniffer, you can see all the strings in the packets, and it's easy to figure out what's going on. When it's byte format, it's a lot harder. So what's happening nowadays is because the networks are getting faster, people are saying, or tend to say, bytes are harder to debug, so unless we really need speed, go for string formats in the first place. So most of your newer protocols are string-based. But your pseudocode for a byte format would be, you got an input stream, you read a byte from the input stream, you do a switch on that byte, and you've got the different messages that are being sent. And if you're going to use those, then you need to use things that you can do read bytes, write bytes. So from the input stream, you wrap them in a data input stream or a data output stream so that you can do read byte, write byte. So for example, if you wanted to write an array of four integers, You might have some array that's come from somewhere. You set up an output stream, data output stream, and then write the byte saying how many you're sending. You're sending four integers, and the first this preceded by a single byte that tells how big the array is. And then follow it with write integer, the four integer values. So that would end up as a, if it's four byte integers, that would end up as a 4x4+1, 17 byte message to get that array across to the other side. And then on the other side, to read them in, read the single byte, which is the size, create an array of that size, and then read the four integers in. That works okay until you get to unsigned types. A lot of the protocols, C programming has signed and unsigned data types, unsigned integers, unsigned bytes, and so on. And a lot of the protocols will say that they want to use unsigned values. So, for example, the time protocol is a 32-bit unsigned integer, which says the number of seconds since 1970, or something like that. Pretty obscure, but you can't deal with unsigned bytes. So there are methods, there are methods for unsigned bytes, there are methods from unsigned shorts. What the return value is, an unsigned byte may be bigger than a signed byte. An unsigned byte will be -128 up to 127. An unsigned will be 0 to 255. So the top values will be bigger than than a signed byte. So it returns an integer type. And similarly, a short, which is a 2-byte, the top values of that will be too big for a short, so they return as an integer type. When you come to unsigned ints, you need to return them as longs. But there isn't a read long method, so you read them as an integer, and sometimes they end up negative. So for unsigned values, if you want to make them positive, so the negative ones you've got to sort of take from the bottom and put them up to the top, there's a conversion factor to change them from being negative reads to positive. And if you have to read unsigned longs, you have to use this big integer class. Characters. In character format, you send everything, if possible. So just the start of this, and then carry on with the rest of it next week. So in character mode, you send everything as characters, and it's a lot easier to do some things with it, but it's a lot slower normally. And what you do for that is, even if you've got an integer, you write it in, say, decimal format, and then you turn it into a string of decimal characters. So if you want to send the integer 1024, you send the four ASCII characters 1, 0, 2, and 4. You still have that same kind of thing. The start of the message is typically a line that represents the message. But in order to figure it out, if it's a single byte, you read byte. But now you've got to read a line and figure out which is the first word on the line. So you need to use string handling to decode it. And then you maybe have successive lines contain more data. And so you need to use more string handling things and line handling things to do things. And there's more options for sending things like arrays. You can do things like send blank lines, because a blank line with no number on it isn't a number. So you can mark the end of a list of numbers that way. So the pseudocode looks like things like you set it up for the being able to read a line, and then you look at whether that line starts with one string or another. So if the line starts with get, then it's a get request. If the line starts with post, then it's a post request, and so on. They're easier to set up, but then there's a whole bunch of problems with them. How are we going to talk? We'll talk about the problems next week.